So, yeah, all good. Last 2 weeks, I shared with you some lessons and reflections from the banquet in that great conference that I was telling you about when I went to America. And I told you that the banquet had three presentations with three beautiful messages. So today I'm going to share with you the third message, but I'm not going to take so long to do it. But it is a beautiful message. I'll tell you the story and the message as well. And then I want to talk about Hanukkah. I think Hanukkah is around the corner. A powerful festival. Worth understanding exactly how Hanukkah works. And then today is actually the last lesson for the term. So we're going to start again the beginning of February, first week of February. I'll send out details and everything, but we're going to take a break after this. Just to mention also that we have some stuff in the next few weeks. We have the summer learning program, which starts the 25th of December. It's a Thursday, actually, I think. It's in 2 weeks' time. Right? So next Thursday, one of the classroom, 2 weeks' time, there's a summer learning program. Follow the details on the WhatsApps and on the emails. Also, during the summer, I don't know the details with me exactly, but I'll send them out on the broadcast. We're not going to have Thursday morning, but I am going to send out during some of the weeks, like a weekly message, a personal growth message. So if you want to, if you're not on that, some of you are probably on that WhatsApp group already. I used it last year, but if you're not, I'll send down the link so you can subscribe to it and get the messages. Okay. So before we get to Hanukkah, let me share with you the third story. So the third story has a beautiful message, but it was just a beautiful story. And it's about a Marine soldier in the U.S. Army called Benjamin Craig, who's been a U.S. Marine soldier for 10 years, enlisted in the Marines. Well, I'll tell you the story. So he grew up in Boston, near Boston. He spoke first. Knew that he was Jewish, but knew nothing about Jewishness. He didn't know, this is quite rare. I mean, I think in Australia it's very rare, but we're not talking about Shabbos observance. He didn't know what Shabbos was. Like, he didn't know what it was altogether. So they never had Friday night, didn't do anything, right? He didn't know what tefillin was. He didn't know anything Jewish. And when it came time, his mother said to him around 13, you know, some people have a bar mitzvah or whatever. And he's not interested, so he never had a bar mitzvah either. And then when he got older, he was quite a determined guy, but he was looking for a bit of meaning and purpose for the future. So he joined the Marine Corps training, which was very rigorous. I was actually thinking about a course, a series he once did. Some of you might remember about Make the Bed, exactly. Yeah. The guy also...
That guy was a SEAL.
Yeah, he was a SEAL, yeah. But the training they give them, like, is crazy. It's like, and he describes it actually, he says, like, the culture is you get off the bus when you come to the training, and there's like, right away a culture where, like, we don't need you here, you need us. In other words, you want to become a Marine, we don't need you. So, and everyone's screaming and shouting, like, right from the first minute, he says, it's unbelievable. But it makes tough people, which is not a bad thing. So he did that. Then he got posted to, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Okinawa in Japan.
Okinawa,
there we are, okay, in Japan. And this is August 2020. And as often happens, this is an interesting thing with the Jewish people. When Jews, even Jews who know nothing about Judaism, suddenly become very isolated, they look for Judaism, which is an amazing thing, right? So, and he never even met an Orthodox rabbi in his life. Like, he met a Reformed rabbi, not a rabbi. So he went to some chaplain there, the non-Jewish chaplain, and he said to him, is there anything Jewish around here? So the guy looks at him and says, you're joking, right? So he says, no, I'm not joking. I'm very serious, actually. So he says, okay, no problem. I will introduce you to the Jewish chaplain here, who was a guy, a Chabad guy, who went to move to Japan to be on, there's a very big U.S. Army base there. And he lives there. And he's the Jewish chaplain for the army. His name is Rabbi Pekar. Youngish guy. I think I learned with his father in Yeshiva. I think so. Same name, but I think it's his father. They got talking. And he said when he first met him, he couldn't believe it. He'd never seen a rabbi. You know, the beard with tzitzis hanging out. And like a different creation. He never knew what it was. Yeah, exactly, like an alien. So the rabbi said to him, you know, we need to get to know each other. Why don't you come for Shabbos? He looks at the rabbi and he says, what's Shabbos? Imagine that, like it's unbelievable. Right? That's how distant it was.
So wonder he knew he was Jewish.
He just knew he was Jewish.
Yeah, well, wonder he knew he was Jewish if he didn't know what Shabbos was.
Yeah, I know. It's
how old was incredible.
He was like in his 20s.
Yeah.
And he, the rabbi invited him for Shabbos. He got to know the rabbi and his wife and they got became friendly. Then he introduces tefillin to him. He says, why don't you put on tefillin? Don't know what that was. But he did it and became very good friends with the rabbi. And he got really involved. The point of the story, Ab, is this, that the story ends with, he got then, Rabbi Pekar remained in Japan, but he then got posted somewhere else. And he had then come to the stage from not knowing even what Shabbos is, to taking candidates that come to the Marine thing the first time, and he's in charge of them, and he gives them a weekly parsha share. And he puts on tefillin with them. And that was the point of the story. It's an amazing, it's just amazing. It ended up very beautifully because it ended up that Makar and him were on stage. And then apparently he's actually getting married soon. So in the front of all these 6,000 rabbis, they gave him a beautiful present for his marriage. And it was a very beautiful thing. But why was that so moving? Because it really is the point, even in the whole Shlichus concept that the Rebbe began, it's the point of how you inspire someone. And there's two ways to inspire someone. You know, there's that famous secular saying that says, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach him to fish and you feed him for a lifetime, right? That's the famous thing. But there's that concept where you can inspire someone and they're inspired, but they're inspired for themselves. But they don't pass it forward, necessarily. They don't become someone that then sees it as a responsibility or believes in themselves to have the ability to inspire others. So Rabbi Sachs famously said about his experience with Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Sachs famously said, that he said it many times, that the greatness of the Lubavitcher Rebbe wasn't there many, many great leaders, but he was a leader that didn't make followers, he made leaders. And you see it going down the chain. So the Rebbe sent out an army of what you call the Shluchim, the people, emissaries around the world, and then many of them, if they're successful, are successful not only in inspiring people, but inspiring them to inspire others, right? But it's a really important lesson for everyone because we all have a circle of influence and we all have to, this is how Judaism works, right? Judaism generally works by a chain. So we've been inspired by the previous generations. King Solomon famously said, Shema Bini, listen my son to the words of your father, don't forsake the Torah of your mother, and so on. All that about learning from others and then teaching others. The obligation to teach others. You know, it's interesting, yesterday and the day before, in the Chabad calendar was a special day called Yutet Kislev, the 19th and 20th of Kislev. The 20th of Kislev also begins a cycle of, well, it's actually the 19th of Kislev. In Chabad communities, there's a sort of a daily learning cycle where we learn a portion of Chumash every day, a portion of Tehillim, Psalms every day, and we learn a piece of Tanya every day, and Rambam. So the Tanya cycle begins on the 19th of Kislev. And today's portion actually is the second part of the Alter Rebbe's introduction to Tanya. And in that introduction, he writes the following. He says he composed the book of Tanya because it was getting really hard to see everyone personally and to answer their questions. So he says, I know who I'm writing for, and I'm putting a lot of the answers to the questions in this book, in the Tanya. Then he says that in case you study the Tanya, you're not sure exactly what it means, you're not sure how to apply it or what it means to you, you must seek the advice of the experts, people always, the people who are well-versed in Hasidic philosophy, in Tanya, in your city. And then he gives a very stern warning to those leaders, to those rabbis or those Torah scholars. And he says, "V'al yihi moneh bar, do not hold back. Don't be humble and say you don't know the answer. Don't be able to say, I don't know how to help you. Because he says, it's well known in the Talmud, the great punishment, he says. Very sharp words he writes. For those that hold back and don't share what they have. In other words, it's fun, right? So he says that you're part of this journey. You have to help me out by inspiring other people when they come to you with a question about what it means and how they can seek help. If you have anything to share, you need to share. Right? And the Rebbe during his lifetime was very, very into this. He would... He would tell people, like, you know, people who came and they gave a lot of drushes, they gave a lot of sermons. He would say, why don't you write a book? Or like, people would say, like, I don't know if I'm worthy for that. You say, you're worthy, do it, just do it, right? No one's perfect, and that's fine. But as we said a few weeks ago, as the previous Rebbe said, if you know an Aleph, you need to share that Aleph. You need to still learn the Bet, but you need to share what you know, you need to share it further. Because that's the responsibility of Jews. It's the responsibility of the Jewish people. It's the responsibility not only to absorb and to be inspired ourselves, but then when we become inspired, to share that with others, to teach others, right? There's a famous, I'm sure I've shared this with you before, but there's a famous concept, you know, in the beginning of Bereshit, in the beginning of the Torah, we learn about Abraham, but before that we learn about Noach. So Noach was the Torah describes him as a righteous person, who lived in his time that was a very immoral and evil time just before the flood. And because he was a moral person and a righteous person, God saved him and his family, and that's the story of the flood, and he built the ark in order to be saved, right? And then came Avraham Avinu 10 generations later. And the Zohar contrasts the two. And the Zohar says that actually there's a great criticism on Noah. Yes, he was a righteous person. It's true. He was worthy to be saved. He was not worthy to perish in a flood and so on and so forth. But he doesn't come anywhere near Abraham. Why? The fundamental difference was, the Zohar doesn't talk in Yiddish, but there's a famous Yiddish saying that Noah was, as we call it, a tzaddik in pelts. In a fur coat. What does that mean? Because they say that when you need to warm up, when it's cold, there's two ways to do that. One is you can put on a fur coat. The other one is you can light a fire. The difference is when you put on a fur coat, you warm it, everyone else is still cold. When you light a fire, everyone becomes warm, right? So that's what we say. Yes, true, Noach was a tzaddik, but a tzaddik in pelts. He was a tzaddik in a fur coat. Worried about himself, and that's it. The story we learn from this story is, no, that's not the fundamental. Avraham Avinu was totally different. Avraham Avinu, his whole life was about giving to others and inspiring others and teaching others. And he created a great following of monotheistic people that would believe in the way he believed. And he brought them closer and he brought them to engage. So the problem is that we often think, well, no, I'm too busy with myself. I'm so still on a low level. Take this guy. I mean, he came from nothing, right? And I'm sure he's at the moment, he's still not exactly your classic Torah scholar, right? I mean, he hasn't gone to yeshiva. He hasn't learned a huge amount. And he was a guy that knew nothing. And yet, whatever he knows, he shares. Right? That doesn't exempt him or any of us from keeping on growing ourselves. That's a very important part of this equation. Because sometimes it happens that people start to give and they forget they also need to grow. So therefore, their giving becomes limited because they give what they got, but they haven't got that much necessarily. And therefore, they come to an end. They don't have any more to give. Right? So it works both ways. We have to keep on growing ourselves, people learning ourselves, everyone. Keep on really growing, and then we keep sharing what we grow with. There's a very interesting, in a bit of a different way, but it brings out a little bit of the same point. There's the Talmud and the Gemara and all the Jewish sources talk extensively about the greatness of giving tzedakah, giving charity, right? Tzedakah in the classic sense means when you give a person money when they're hungry and they don't know what to eat or what to wear. It's a welfare system that the Torah encourages and sets up that you need to help people who don't have, right? And we know that there are various levels of charity and anonymous versus probably all sorts of things. And then there's a mitzvah in the Torah which also is considered part of the tzedakah journey, and that is to give someone a loan. Right? If someone comes, they want to start a business, they want to invest, they want to put themselves back on their own feet, whatever the case is, and they want to borrow money, there's a mitzvah to try and help them, right? And the interesting thing is that the Talmud says that giving someone a loan, obviously when it's appropriate, and when you believe it can work, it's greater than tzedakah, greater than charity. And the obvious question is why? I mean, the loan you're going to get back. Tzedakah is selfless. You're giving away something you're not going to get back, right? But the answer is not in terms of my gain, but it's in terms of what I'm accomplishing. So when you give someone a loan and the person can then get themselves back on their own feet, and they can be self-sufficient and therefore help others going forward, that's greater than giving them tzedakah. Tzedakah, you give them for today, they have what to eat, and that's it. Going like to that saying, you give them a fish, they eat for a day. But when you help them set themselves up and you help them be established, then they can help other people. And they, first of all, it's more long term, and second of all, they're then able to employ other people and help other people and give tzedakah and so on and so forth. Obviously, that's not, it's not always the case. Many times people just need food or need assistance, so that's different. But when that opportunity arises, it's so much so encouraged, and it's even considered something that is in a way greater than tzedakah, because you're putting them on their own feet and they can then become productive and help other people. So, just a little lesson, and I found that it was a very beautiful presentation, and I found that lesson just always worth remembering, that we have an obligation, just like those who taught us fulfilled their obligation to teach us, we have right away an obligation to teach others. And I guess the important part is not to wait till we think we're a great leader. No, whatever we have, we need to then help other people. Okay, so that's just the third message. Hanukkah. So I wanted to talk about Hanukkah a little bit, because actually we don't often get a chance in this Thursday morning, because often Hanukkah is a bit later, so we're on holiday already. But I thought we'd talk about Hanukkah a little bit and just learn one of the messages from Hanukkah and understand its real depth. So Hanukkah takes place roughly about 100, 150 years before the Common Era, towards the end of the Second Temple. We all know the story. The Greeks, actually it wasn't really Greeks, it was Syrians with Greek culture, were in charge of Israel at that time. They led a campaign to Hellenize and to assimilate the Jews of the time in the land of Israel. They wanted them to become very part of the hedonistic and physical material culture of the Greek Empire. And they were very brutal about it. And then eventually the Maccabim, who are very few handful of people, waged the war against them and won the war miraculously. But actually that miracle we mention on Hanukkah, but it's not actually so focused. It's not so highlighted on Hanukkah. What's more highlighted is the second miracle. And the second miracle was that they came to the temple. When they won the war, they came back to the temple. They restored the sovereignty of the Jewish people for a while. And they found the temple ransacked. And Talmud says that they found that the Greeks had come in, the Yevanim had come in and ransacked the temple. But more highlighted is this phrase, Tim'u kol hashmanim. They impurified all the oil. They made it impure. And that's why they wanted to restart the daily mitzvah of kindling the menorah, the candelabra in the temple. And they couldn't because they didn't have any pure olive oil. It says the Talmud, until they found one jug of oil, famous thing, which had the seal of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest. The only problem is that oil had enough to light for one day, where to produce the new pure olive oil, halachically correct, for kindling the menorah, would take 8 days, and therefore this jug of oil, instead of lighting for one day, lived for 8 days. And therefore that became the miracle of Hanukkah, and we celebrated for 8 days, and every night we light the menorah. We light menorah of eight, in ascending order, one on the first day, eight on the last night, to remember that miracle. So, there's a couple of things we need to understand. First of all, why is that the focus of Hanukkah? I mean, it was a big miracle, it was. But it's a miracle. I mean, why should that become the basis of the entire festival? What does that miracle actually mean? What's the symbolism of that miracle, right? Very nice, the burn for 8 days, it's a miracle. Many miracles happen throughout Jewish history, which we don't necessarily make a whole yontif out of. And not only that, we even we don't even highlight so much the miracle of the military victory, which was a huge miracle. It was a miracle of survival. I mean, you had a handful of Kohanim who went out there and fought this mighty war, and they won, right? So that's an incredible miracle. It was a statistical impossibility. And yet they won the war, which we talk about on Hanukkah, but not really that much. If you look at any of the sources that explain Hanukkah and explore the depth of Hanukkah, it's all about the oil. The oil, the oil, the oil, and the miracle that it lasted for 8 days. Okay, so that's an interesting question. We need to understand what is the power of that miracle. Second thing is, I want to share with you a very, very famous Hanukkah question. In yeshivot, where they learn, this is like a standard thing. Everyone knows this question. And the question comes from someone called the Bet Yosef. The Bet Yosef was Rabbi Yosef Karo. He was the author of the first original Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, a great Kabbalist and Halachist that lived in Tzfat around the 15th century. And he has a commentary called Bet Yosef. And he asks this question. He says he doesn't understand why Hanukkah is 8 days. Why is it 7 days? Why? He says, listen, they found the jug of oil, right? The jug of oil had enough to light for one night. But it lasted for 8 nights. So what's the miracle? How many nights is the miracle?
Seven.
So if you're celebrating the miracle, it should be 7 days. Right? You get the question? There are hundreds of answers in this question. It became such a famous question somehow that everyone who's a Talmudist or halachist that likes to explore Hanukkah wants to try to suggest answers to this question. He himself gives a couple of answers. Yeah, inside the question, so it should be 7 days. So one of the answers, which I want to share with you and spiritually unpack it, is that there was a miracle on the first day as well. And it was a different miracle, but a very powerful and foundational miracle. The miracle is, on the first day we celebrate a different miracle. The miracle is that they found the jug of oil. They found that one jug of oil that still had the seal of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest. And then it miraculously burned for an extra 7 days. But the miracle is that they found that jug of oil. The question is, why is that so significant? Okay, they found the oil, very nice. It was hidden somewhere, they happened to find it. That itself was miraculous, but why? Like, what does it represent? What's the idea? Okay. Thirdly, I want to just highlight a question before we get into the answer. That one of the customs of Hanukkah, not a particularly healthy custom, but is the eating of donuts.
Yes.
Right?
I noticed it's twice on the piece of paper.
Oh, you say donuts twice? Yeah, no, because donuts are very important. So there's a general question and a specific question. The general question is, why do we Jews connect every festival with food?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? If you think about it, it's an amazing thing. Every festival is connected with food. Yeah, but special foods, like, right?
Pesach
is matzah, maror, 4 cups of wine. Mitzvah. Some of them are biblical mitzvahs that you have to eat, right? Some of them are custom, sorry? Milchiks, exactly, cheesecake, blintzes. I mean, I'm not complaining, I'm just saying, I just want to, I'm very far from complaining. I just want to understand it, right? Rosh Hashanah's apple and honey and all the other things we eat, all the simanim. So someone told me, I gave the shiur recently, and he said, yeah, but Yom Kippur doesn't have to do with food. That's not true.
We start with food,
we end with food, and we have special foods.
Exactly.
Some people have a custom on Erev Yom Kippur to eat kreplach, to eat honey cake, and to have yontif meals. Yes, I mean, sukkah, the whole mitzvah is eating the sukkah the whole week.
Shabbos,
yontif, exact Shabbos foods, yontif foods. We don't stop, right? Yeah. Tu Bishvat, we eat fruit. Purim, we eat hamantashen. It's an amazing thing if you think about it. Like, it's a weird religion. We always...
Jewish
sorry?
Jewish tradition is
yeah, that's it. Esmein kin, exactly. Yeah. I think that was an extension of all the customs that people came. I saw, you know, obviously, so there is a minute to eat donuts on Pesach. By the way, not only donuts, it's actually.
Oily.
What's that?
Just oily food.
Oily food, right. I grew up actually, I never even knew there was a minute to eat donuts on Pesach, on Hanukkah. Because in my house, they made latkes.
Nah, yeah.
Right? Latkes. You see, the South African minute was to eat latkes.
Sugar over there.
You really want to know?
Yes.
And I asked, they used to put sugar and cinnamon on the latkes. It wasn't enough that it was like deeply fried in the oil.
Sugar.
Yeah.
And sour cream.
Sour cream or applesauce.
Sugar, yeah.
I saw a meme once that a guy says, I observe the mitzvah of eating Hanukkah of eating donuts. Like the Hanukkah cans. I eat one on the first night, two on the second night, three on the third night. Yeah. So what is the idea? What is the idea of donuts specifically? What is the idea in general about eating every yantar, right? And you should know, I'm saying with some level of seriousness, because it's not just, we have a tradition that when something is a Jewish minhag, right? It's for a different discussion, but the power of a custom is very, very deep. We are taught in the Talmud that minhag Yisrael Torahi. When Jewish communities have a sort of a collective divine inspiration, when Jewish communities or Klal Yisrael in general take on customs, even though they're not obligatory, so to speak, from the Torah, not one of the 613 mitzvot or the 7 rabbinic mitzvot, but the customs have tremendous depth and holiness, we are taught, right? And actually, we need to be very careful not to change them. In fact, it's written in many places, when you change minhagim, you change customs, that's what breaks the Jewish chain. When you start tampering with the customs. The customs are very, very deep and very powerful. So what is this custom? Okay. So let's talk about Hanukkah in general. Hanukkah, we know, different to Purim. the war that the Greeks had against the Jewish people, even though it was very brutal, and even though they threatened them with their life and violence, but actually the war was not a physical war. The war was a spiritual war. And a very dangerous spiritual war. I often think about what is happening in our society. There's a similar war going on, but we'll talk about that in a moment. It was a spiritual. Why do I say that? So we find throughout, we have a long history of anti-Semitism and violence and danger and so on and so forth. And it comes in different forms, right? The threat comes in different forms. So there are times, like the story of Purim, where actually the war was very physical. Haman didn't care about the mitzvot. Yes, mitzvot, no mitzvot. He just didn't want the Jews altogether. Let's get rid of them, right? Which is why, by the way, on Purim, the celebration is very physical. I mean, it's a very deep day, but it's very physical. Because, it's about eating a meal and sending fruit baskets and so on. It's all very physical stuff. Hanukkah was a spiritual war. That's why the observance is more spiritual, lighting of candles and so on. Yet we eat anyway, but as we'll soon see. So there's different types of forms of threats. One is a physical threat. The Holocaust, for example, is similar. They didn't care about what we did or didn't do. They just didn't want us. Right? They went back four generations and they wanted to eradicate every single Jew. Then we have throughout history, we have wars against the Jewish people that target Jewish practice. Jewish practice. I know, from a personal point of view, historically, my parents come from Russia. Chabad movement generally originates in Russia. So the communists, when they came in, communism, right? Yeah, so their war was Jewish practice. No cheders, no mikveh, no matzah, no tefillin. You know, that was their war, right? But when they fought that war, what remained with the Jewish people is their faith. And therefore many, many, many people, many great Hasidim, many, many, even simple Hasidim, many great people, there were those that just were not educated and they just were swept up in the communistic culture. But there were those that stayed very, very strong and they didn't succeed at the end of the day. There were still underground Chadorim, there were underground mikvahs. Why? Because the threat was against Jewish practice, but the Jewish faith remained. The emunah remained. Because they didn't make a campaign to rid people of their faith. They don't care what you believe, just as long as you don't do. But with Jews, when you have faith, even though they're trying to threaten you not to do, you fight back. Because the faith is strong. The Hanukkah war was very different. In fact, the Hanukkah war was less on practice and more on faith. It was a war on emunah. A war on changing the mind, the mindset of the Jew. Not to believe in God. So I'll explain, just unpack that for a second. On Hanukkah, we have a paragraph that we say in the Amidah called Al Hanisim. It's a paragraph we describe, in brief, the miracle of Hanukkah. And we describe what the war was about, what the threat was about. And we say there the following. We say that the Greeks came and they attempted to make the Jews forget the Torah. But the way we say it is lehashkicham toratecha. They wanted to make your nation forget your Torah. What does that mean, your Torah? It doesn't say they wanted to make them forget the Torah. They wanted to make them forget your Torah. What does that mean? We have to understand that the Greek culture was a very sophisticated culture. They were cultured people, they were academic people. But what they were completely empty of was any form of spirituality and godliness. Right? So actually, Jewish culture didn't bother them. Jewish observance didn't bother them that much. Even Jewish academia didn't bother them that much. They weren't so bothered by the fact that the Jews would continue to explore the pages of the Talmud. I mean, the Talmud wasn't there yet, but the idea, the Jewish learning. But they wanted it to be treated as a secular academic subject like any other subject. In other words, they wanted to take the God out of the Torah. Which is what we mean when we say that they wanted the Jews to forget, not to forget the Torah, they can keep learning, but lashkicham toratecha, to forget that it's your Torah, that there's a holiness to it, there's a spirituality to it, there's a connection to God, there's a Jewish continuity that's attached to it. All that they wanted to take away. And the same thing with the mitzvot. We know, we've said this many, many times, that there's different types of mitzvot. There are mitzvot which make sense, a rational mitzvot called mishpatim. Then there are mitzvot which are chukim, the mitzvot that we do because we believe. We don't know why, but we believe. Right? We believe, so we do it. Many examples of such mitzvot. Kashrut itself is one of those mitzvot, for example. People often try to explain kashrut because it's healthy. I'm not sure schmaltz herring is much healthier than much healthier than shrimp, but right. So I'm not sure if health is exactly the issue, but it's not. It's actually a spirit. It's because God said so. Yeah, I mean there are explanations and the Kabbalistic ideas. Of course, we try as best we can to internalize and relate to it. But at the end of the day, God said you can't. You're not supposed to wear a garment which has wool and linen in it together.
Yeah.
Reason? Don't know. So why do we keep it? Because we surrender. Why do we surrender? Because we believe. That's it. We believe that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, so it's part of the Torah, so it's true. And it's applicable and it's binding. But it's, right? So that's the chukim. And then in Hasidic philosophy, we learn that it's deeper than that. Every mitzvah has two aspects. Every mitzvah has the rational side to the mitzvah, things you could understand. Even the chukim have things you could understand. And then every mitzvah has the surrender part to it. Like I'm keeping it up, even though it has a reason, but I don't keep it because it's got a reason. I like the reason, I enjoy the reason. But I keep it because God says so. Even the ones that make sense, right? I keep it because of faith. So we continue in that same paragraph. We say that the Greeks wanted the Jews to forget your Torah, and they also wanted to take them away mechukei retzonecha, from the chukim of your will. Meaning they wanted to, they weren't worried about the Jews having symbols, having cultural symbols, Jewish symbols. Jewish culture was not a problem for them. The faith was a problem for them. The godliness was a problem for them. Right? And they didn't want people to keep the mitzvah from the chukim perspective, from the faith perspective. You want to do a mitzvah because it makes sense to you and you like it and it's culturally appropriate? Go for it. But you want to do it because God said that? No, we need to take God out of the picture. Right? Which is why they established a society, as we know, that served the God was the body. Right? Was not that we should do exercise, be healthy, of course we should, but to them, that was it. That was the end game. The physical body, sports stadiums, they served the body. They served all these different shows they made and so on. That was the Greek culture. Taking God out of the picture, letting the physical world and hedonism be the God of the day. And that was the war. That was the spiritual war of the Hellenists. And it worked, by the way. Why? Because that type of war is the most dangerous. If you damage Jewish observance and Jewish engagement, but the faith remains, it's easier to come back and it's easier to re-engage. But when you damage the faith and you change the minds and the thinking of people, you're in big trouble. Because that's very hard to change back. Right? And they succeeded. You have to understand historically, who fought the war? The Maccabim, right? How many were the Maccabim? There weren't a lot of people. En masse, the Jewish people were Hellenizing. They were becoming part of the Greek culture. And there was a lot at stake. Jewish continuity was at stake in the Hanukkah story. Fighting back and restoring Jewish faith and Jewish engagement and observance was under threat. Much more under threat than with other anti-Semitism expressions that we had throughout history. So the question is, oh, sorry, before we go further. And this is the symbolism, what the Talmud tells us, that the Greeks came into the temple and they defiled the oil. Why were they attacking the oil? So oil is a symbol of emunah, symbol of faith. Why is it? Because if you know how oil works, right, you can pour oil into every liquid and it won't mix. It remains transcendent, right? Remains transcendent. What does that symbolize? It symbolizes a transcendent expression of ourselves. Something which is higher than the consciousness, higher than intellect, higher than rationale. That's what faith is. Faith is about belief. It's about believing in something where we don't understand, as we've talked about many times. Believing in something that we don't relate to, don't understand, but we know God has a plan. He's higher than us. He knows better. That's how we do his mitzvot, even though it doesn't make sense. That's why we accept sometimes when negative things happen. We don't always know the plan. We don't like the plan. But we believe in it. And that's oil. That's a symbolism of oil. To use Kabbalistic language, the Sherman is called Chochmah of the Nefesh. It's that Chochmah, which is the clarity of truth. It's clarity. It's like when someone... And normally, emunah means... Strong emunah means that we have a clarity that in the mystical sources is compared to seeing something as opposed to hearing about it. Right? If I convince you that there's a table in the next room with a rational argument, You might believe me, but at the back of your mind, you know, well, yeah, but I mean, maybe it'll be disproven, right? If you see the table, you've seen it. It's your, it's there, finished. Okay, you can't refute it. It's what it is, right? Okay. That's shemen, that's oil. So that's what it means in a deeper level where the Greeks came to the temple and they went for the oil. Because that symbolized their whole fight, their whole war. The war was that let's tamper with the faith of the Jewish people. Let's tamper with the emunah. Let's tamper with the shemen of the Jewish people. Yeah, no, so that's always a question. Very interesting question. Yeah. So the fact that they tampered with the faith, we know, because that's what they did. And so in Kabbalah, we have a lot of things like that. Even Haman doing things in Purim, which symbolize certain Kabbalistic things. It doesn't mean that he necessarily knew the Kabbalah about it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they knew the symbolism of oil Kabbalistically, right?
Yeah.
But we know that any force of evil in this world has a spiritual origin. And sometimes spiritual origin that directs their physical counterparts, so to speak, to do certain things. So they might not have even known why they're doing it. But it was an outcome of what they did. They were fighting the faith of the Jewish people, so somehow it led to them doing something which symbolized that, which was impurifying the oil. Okay. So now the question is, so how do you fight back then? How do you redeem that? Understand? If the faith remains, just the consciousness is damaged, or the action is damaged, the behavior is damaged, so you fight it with faith. When your faith is damaged, how do you fight it? Sorry?
Donuts.
What? With donuts. Yeah, we'll see. No, donuts is the second part. Part two. But we'll see in a second. Okay. So the answer is as follows. And it's a little bit deep. I hope we'll be able to cover it in a few minutes. That actually, the Hasidic sources tell us that there's two levels of faith. And it actually ties in with the following. Ties with something I've shared with you many times, that the soul has five levels. The first three are known nefesh, ruach, neshama. That's known as the conscious part of the soul. Intellect, emotion, and action. Then there's two transcendent layers. One is called chaya, another one is called yechida. Faith lives on both of them, but they're different types of faith. So the first level of faith, which we've been talking about, the shemen, which is normally the faith that we have, is a faith that is transcendent. It's not rational. It's we believe in something because we know there's something higher than us. But it's and it has a clarity to it. But it's a clarity that's connected. It's connected to the rational. In other words, just put it simply like this, right? If I'm a rational person, I can come to the conclusion that I'm a limited person. Therefore, there are things beyond me. God is beyond me. He's smarter than me. He knows more than me. He sees wider than me. Right? Okay, so it's a faith, it's not an intellectual faith, but it's intellectual faith that even an intellectual person can come to terms that it exists. Right? Person is engaged Jewishly and understands, and the Torah was given man's son, and God gave it. So God obviously must be much higher than me, and therefore he's transcendent, and therefore I believe in that transcendence, and I even enter an experience of faith which is not intellectual and not rational. And I'll do things even though to me it doesn't make sense, because I know there's more to me than just me. Yeah?
Trusting in the
process. Yeah, kind of thing. That is the normal faith that we use on a day-to-day basis. But there's a deeper faith. And that's the faith of the fifth level. And that's a faith that can never, ever be damaged. You see, the first level of faith, with good arguments and strong influence, can be damaged. The Greeks did it very well. In other words, you can say, maybe I'm famished. I thought I saw a table, but I don't really see it. Right, even seeing it, so you can undermine that. It can be undermined. It can be damaged. But then there's a faith that a Jew has at the very depth of their neshama, and that's the fifth level of faith, which is can never be damaged. It can be hidden, right? It can be hidden. You might not be aware of it, but it can never be damaged. Always there. No matter what is done to the Jew, it can never be damaged. An example of this faith. Sorry? Exactly. So we did this, right? We went through this. Eli Sharabi is not a religious person. Came from a secular background. And yet somehow, when it's challenged, when his Jewishness was challenged, and he was asked to read from the Quran, and he was promised more food, which was vital to his survival, he said no. He risked his life, and others did too. Why? He was consciously not that Jewish. But when his Jewishness was openly challenged, that spark at the very depth of his neshama came out. There's no way to explain it. it can be very hidden, and sometimes in a day-to-day, it is hidden. But when it comes out, it comes out. And when it comes out, there's no stopping it. It's a deeper level of faith.
Is it also to do with Zionism?
Go on.
Because, you know, like, people can accept that we have traditions and how we, you know, follow all the different festivals and all that sort of thing, but they can't understand why Israel is so important to us.
Okay, so that's actually a very good question, but the which really deserves its own shiur. But yeah. But in a nutshell,
yeah.
Depends what we mean by Zionism. So,
yeah.
The love of Israel and the importance of Israel
yeah.
really is inseparable from the rest of the Torah, being Jewish.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with
right.
that.
Right, and so it goes together.
We
but
like the Jews in the diaspora, but we don't like the Jews in Israel because they're Zionists.
Yeah, no, so obviously, yeah, because yeah. that's just a. Yeah. Rabbi Sacks talks about this a lot. That's just an excuse for real anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, because.
Yeah.
Because
yeah, and, I understand yeah, that, yeah, I understand yeah. that, but why do they feel that if they differentiate, it's acceptable? That's what I'm trying to understand.
But you see, they don't differentiate. That they've proven themselves wrong over the last 2 years. Yeah. What's been proven the last 2 years is they start with Israel as an excuse, because it's a nice way to cover up for the anti-Semitism. Say, you know, I'm not really against Jews, but I'm just against Israel. Yeah. And what the last 2 years have shown is that's just not true, because you're anti-Semitic all over the world,
yeah.
and you're targeting Jews all over the world.
Yeah.
So they themselves have proven that the two things are inseparable.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's right. Okay. So that's right. So that okay. So when you have a spiritual war, when you have a spiritual war that is attacking. And by the way, it's not just Eli Shirai, but we've seen many, many stories over the last 2 years. Just the in most unexpected ways, that fifth level of Amunah just coming out.
Like you said, that first story of that soldier.
Yes, the soldier.
Look at the soldiers in Israel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's incredible. I witnessed it myself when I was in Israel in May, just the completely secular soldiers talking about Amunah, Amunah. Because when we're under threat. So that's the problem. The problem is that the faith comes out a lot of times under threat. Okay, so... So that's what happened on Hanukkah. So therefore, what needed to be done? The faith was damaged. So how do you fight back? The answer is the first level of faith was damaged. But the deepest level of faith was never damaged. Now, we said before that emunah is shemen, is oil, correct? So what's the deepest faith? It's the jug of oil that has the seal of the Kohen Gadol. That's what it is. It's that deeper faith. Oil is faith, but the jug of oil that has the seal of the high priest, which means it's protected, it was never defiled, it cannot become impure. Going back to the question of why Hanukkah is 8 days, not 7 days, because the miracle of the first day is that they found the jug of oil. That's the miracle. They found that the deepest faith. And as soon as the deepest faith is found, miracles happen. To burn forever, you know. When we reveal within ourselves our jug of oil, the emunah that we have, the deepest level of the neshama that we have, then the rest is relatively easy. Meaning, then we fight back. Not easy, but I'm saying we fight back. Because that part of emunah can never be damaged. They might influence us, they might confuse our minds, they might change our minds, they might impurify our minds. But they can only do that to the first level of faith. They can't do that to the deepest level of faith. And that's the miracle of the menorah. When they had discovered that, then the miracle could happen and it could last for 8 days. And there was a re-emergence of Jewishness and Jewish engagement. And the Jews returned and reconnected. Jewish sovereignty reconnected. Jewish service reconnected. And the whole thing changed. All turned around. Because that's the only thing that can fight against when your first level of emunah has been damaged. You need to go very deep and expose and reveal and discover the deepest emunah, the jug of oil that had the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Because that faith has infinite power, infinite power. That's why we find something interesting about Hanukkah, before I get to donuts. And that is that the Hanukkah story is actually, we light the menorah on a historic level because we're remembering the miracle that happened with the menorah in the temple. Now, what do I mean by the menorah in the temple? The temple had a menorah of 7 branches. It was kindled every single day of the year, right? That's the original menorah. Our candles we light on Hanukkah remembers the miracle that happened with the menorah. Now, what's interesting is that when the candle, when the menorah was kindled every day in the temple, it was specifically kindled during the day, not at night. Specifically during the day. Because day is holiness. See, day and darkness is holiness and unholiness. Right? Brightness of the day represents holiness, revelation, spirituality, brightness. Nighttime is not a time for menorah. It's darkness, concealment. Hanukkah candles, the halakha is you light them specifically when it's night. Except for Friday, of course. But you try dafke to light it after the sun goes down. Right? Why? Because when you reveal the point, that powerful flame of Jewishness that is the deepest emunah, that can even fight darkness. That can transform darkness. Sometimes darkness is a contradiction to holiness, but not when you reveal your ultimate emunah. Therefore, we light the Hanukkah candles when it's dark, because the idea of the Hanukkah candle, the power of the Hanukkah candles is that it can transform and brighten up even the darkness of the world. Okay. Now, oil has two properties. One is, I mentioned before, it doesn't mix with any other liquid. But as the Talmud says, it doesn't mix with anything, but yet it gets in the way of everything. It goes all over the place. Well, you would know that somewhere along the line you must have had an oil spill in your house. And it's one of the most impossible things to clean up. It just gets everywhere. It sticks to everything, gets everywhere, right? That's
what They sued mealy meal over the oil.
Yeah, because it absorbed the oil. Okay, so it got into the mealy meal, but it's still all over the place, right?
I didn't know that. I ran out of my flat.
Yeah, of course.
For the future.
Yeah. It's a good trick. But the Talmud says, it's also, the Talmud says that shemen, something fatty, mefafer bekula, just goes all over the place. So here's the thing with Hanukkah, and with all Jewish festivals, really. We reveal a concept, we have an idea. Okay, so comes Hanukkah, the menorah flames represent deep emunah. Okay, we're deep emunah, right? Every yontif has its representation of what it represents. But our challenge, or our opportunity, maybe we should say, is not to leave what has been revealed as an isolated thing. It's the purest of oil, it's the deepest emunah. We have to make sure it goes all over the place, that we internalize it. That actually we take it with us and it influences the way we live our life. It doesn't remain this deep spark at the beginning of our soul that only comes out once in a while when we really threaten and there's a tremendous crisis. But it's something we learn to live with every day. And I think, I haven't seen it written clearly in Sfarim, but this is my idea. Whatever I've told you till now is 100%. It's just a suggestion. But I think maybe that's the depth of the donuts. Partly, but eating it. Eating is simple as we know. We do find this many times in the sources. Eating is a form of internalizing, understanding, making it part of who we are. And it's oil, so it goes everywhere, making it part of our emotion, our intellect, our behavior. Everything is imbued, everything is affected, everything gets this shemen, this oil, sticking to it. Because the challenge that we have is that the emunah doesn't remain that just one spark that we admire and we talk about and we tell the history of during the story of Hanukkah, but it becomes something that actually we then take it from the Hanukkah menorah, that which is the symbolism of that emunah, but we make it part of a donut and we eat it and we internalize it, and that's the message that we need to take that with us to internalize it completely in every part of our life. That's the Hanukkah power, the Hanukkah message. That was before. After. Because first came the Greek Empire and then came the Roman Empire.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about roughly about 100 to 200, I'm not sure exactly, I've forgotten, but 100 to 200 years before the Common Era. Yeah. So the Second Temple was destroyed in year 70,
yeah.
Post, in other words.
Yeah.
This was about 200 years before, something like that. Because, so what happened with the Hanukkah story is actually they restored sovereignty to the Jewish people for about 100 years after the story of the Greeks, and then the Romans took over. The Haftarah came under the Romans, I think. I'm pretty sure. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure. Yeah, but that was I think a Roman thing. I think so. Okay, I should give a doc. I can provide you a documented one, but roughly it works like this. So the We have two temples, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Jews leave Egypt and go into Israel.
Yeah.
Takes them about 400 years to actually build a temple, the first temple.
Yeah.
Temple stood for about 410 years and then was destroyed. They went into Babylon for 70 years and then built the second temple. Second temple was built roughly around 400 years before the Common Era, roughly, a bit less, 360 or something. And that's sort of 420 years. But during the second temple was a much more difficult time than the first temple, because the second temple, they didn't have complete sovereignty. The second temple, for the first part, was under Persia, the Persian regime, because at that time Persia had taken over from Babylon. Then it went to the Greeks and the Syrians. Then there was a break where Jewish sovereignty was restored for like 100 years. And then the Romans, and then in year 70, the temple was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And they went into Rome, they went into exile.
Can I ask, why do you need to use a shamash?
Oh, that's an interesting halachic thing. So the origin of the shamash is that and that's just a custom which stayed, but the origin of it is like this, that we light the Chanukah candles and we sing in the song, we say that the Chanukah candles are holy and we're not supposed to derive benefit from them. We're not supposed to use them, meaning to read or to do something or to see something, see a food, whatever, right? Now, you have to understand in context, in the olden days, they had no electricity, right? So the Chanukah candles also serve to give light. But actually, it's a light you weren't supposed to then use. So they used to light an additional light, an additional flame, and that became the flame using kind of thing rather than... Yeah.
The Shabbat candles you can use as light.
Look, the whole purpose of Shabbat candles is... The purpose of Shabbat candles is to have that the Shabbat, that on Shabbat, the reason why they made you light candles, the simple reason why that you have to light Shabbat candles before Shabbat comes in, is because otherwise the house will be dark and then you won't be able to see what you're doing. So therefore they wanted Shabbat to be a peaceful experience, and therefore they said it's a mitzvah to light candles before Shabbat comes in. I mean, there's many other things around it, but that's the historic and halachic background to it. So therefore the goal of Shabbat candles is to use them, whereas the Chanukah candle is not. It's more like, which also applies to what we said, because it's more about that like faith that is it, that holy faith that is the depth of our soul. Yeah.
Are you allowed to move the Chanukah once you've lit it, or is it like Shabbat candles?
You're allowed to, but you shouldn't for the first. So if you light it after dark, you should really leave it in the same place for half an hour, and then you can move it if you want to. Yeah.
Have a bit of a mess. Then you have oil everywhere.
Okay. Have a wonderful day, everyone, and wonderful Hanukkah.